Okay, last week, for those of you who weren't here, we did the three chapters covering the flood, Noah and the ark. But this tonight, we have it more tame. Tonight, the flood has ceased, and we, I call this life after the ark. Because now they're disembarked, and it's a new beginning once again.
There were some great people last week.
Yeah.
We were bobbing around a bit.
Yeah, we were bobbing around a bit, right?
Bad weather, I don't remember.
Yeah, it was. Bitter cold.
So now we're on chapter 9. So just think about this now. How thrilling to experience a brand new beginning. Because remember, the first new beginning was the creation, right? The whole creation of everything that God did. Now, after the flood, it's another new beginning. Because everything was wiped out except for those that were in the ark. So it's kind of a thrilling experience, but it can also be a little scary. But the flood that washed away the wickedness of Cain's civilization had not washed away the sinfulness of the human heart. That was still there. The first 17 verses of chapter 9, what God does is he gives principles. It was for them, and it's also for you and I in our time today, and for the entire human race to live by. So those first 17 verses, we'll talk a little about what those principles were. The first principle that God gave them was principle for government. When Noah came off the ark, he was faced with an entirely empty planet. Clean slate. Where would he go? Where should he live? I mean, God did not leave it up to Noah to guess, but he gave him clear directions. Sometimes don't you feel like God's leaving it up to you to guess? And other times maybe you hear him give you clear directions. Ed, do you have verses 1 and 2? Read that.
Yeah. Then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you will fall on all the beasts of the earth, and on all the birds in the sky, on every creature that moves along the ground, and on all the fish in the sea. They are given into your hands."
So God was commanding Noah right at the very start here now, right from the get-go. He's commanding him to scatter throughout the globe and fill the earth. Okay? Fill the earth so that man could gain control over the earth, making it suitable for human habitation. So when God gave dominion over the earth to Adam and Eve, it was a dominion of love and of understanding. Noah was again given dominion over the earth, because remember, first Adam and Eve were given dominion over the earth. Now God's giving it again to Noah. But this time God said the entire government of the world, including the supremacy of man over every living creature on the earth, would be rooted in fear. Well, that's a little different than what happened when he gave Adam and Eve that dominion. There was not that fear factor. The animals didn't have fear of man in them at that point in time, which is why the serpent was speaking to Eve. But this fear may have been partially for the protection of the human race, because the animals would have multiplied at a lot more rapid rate than the human beings would have. And maybe at that rate they could have exterminated human life before it got a chance to populate more. God was enabling man to take charge of his earthly home. So it's our God-given responsibility as descendants of Noah to exercise rulership over our own environment, wherever we are, in such ways that it will continue to be suitable for human habitation. The next thing that God did now with Noah was he gave him principles of nourishment. God had given Adam and Eve the fruits and vegetables and grains to eat as their dietary nourishment. Now God instructed Noah in verse 3. He said, "Everything that lives and moves will be food for you." So there's a variation already now in what was before. Noah was given all the major food groups for his use at this point. healthy eating is one of God's principles, and of course, if we heed His principles, we'll benefit and enjoy a life that works a lot better than if we don't eat properly. And I think we have a lot of that in our world today. We don't eat properly, and we see the effects of it with a lot of sickness. Excuse me. God gave one prohibition, though. He said not to eat the meat that has its lifeblood still in it. And He was very serious about that. It was given partially for safety and sanitation and food preparation, because remember, in those days there was no refrigeration. So meat that was drained of its blood, the blood of the animal, wouldn't spoil as quickly as meat that still had the blood in it. So there was a practical reason for that, that God didn't lay out and explain and all that. He just said, don't do this. Kind of like us when we have little children and we tell them, don't put your hand in the fire. But we don't explain all the reasons why, because they wouldn't understand us. So we just say, don't do it, Don't run out in the street. They're not going to understand if we try to explain the cars go faster than their little legs and they might die. They won't even know what die means. So we just say, don't do it. Well, God's telling them, don't eat anything with the life blood still in it. This was also the very first in a lengthy list of laws that were later given to Moses later on as time passed to impress the people with the uniqueness of the blood of an animal. God wanted to instill that in them from early on so that they would start to learn about the blood of the lamb as something very special, very unique. God required a blood sacrifice as a means for man to get right with Him, because He said in Hebrews 9:22, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. Ed?
Go back to that lifeblood for a minute. So, mm-hmm. When I read that, I thought that meant to mean you may not kill an animal still alive, but once it's dead, its lifeblood is gone. Even though it's still physically there, you can eat it. You don't. That's not the interpretation.
No.
So they literally have to drain.
The blood has to be drained out of the animal first.
Don't imagine. I don't even know how they would know how to do that.
Well, it's easy. You just make it a cut and you hang it.
And it
drains out. Yes, Devin.
A Baptist preacher got mad at me one day. We were butchering chickens and he was late. And I chopped a bunch of our heads off. When he got on there, he said, how'd you kill our chickens? And I said, well, I chopped our heads off. He got mad at me because you're not supposed to do that, because when you chop their head off, there's a son. You're supposed to slice their throat and let them bleed to death. Hang them upside down. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then they'll drain out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we've been eating them with
all the blood drains when you put their heads on the top of the bucket.
Yeah. So it's different.
But there's one thing about the blood that I think that people don't understand either.
Mm-hmm.
There's the blood is a life sustaining, goes throughout your whole body, right? Mm-hmm. It brings fresh oxygen around. But while it's going around, it's picking up all the corruption that's in your body and bringing it back and filtering it out so mm-hmm. that you're. Mm-hmm. So if you don't drain all the blood, you're leaving all the corruption in there too, whatever could be there.
See, and God that created everything, He knew what's going to be good or bad about that, but He didn't bother to try and explain it to them because it wasn't something that they would understand at that time. He just made a law, He made a rule, and He said, this is what you do. Now, maybe if they would have been more inquisitive and wanted to know why, I don't know. But maybe they didn't think it was important to ask all those questions we think of sometimes.
I got a stupid question to ask, I guess, when we're talking about blood and that. Some people drink the blood mm-hmm. of animals as they're butchering. What do you do if you're a missionary and you go to one of these villages where they weed out the animal and make their...
Mm-hmm. You know what missionaries
drink
do?
Out of it.
They do it. They yeah. do what?
You
know, they do it. I mean.
Yeah, do you drink that or do you just, how do you handle a situation like that? You're going to be all things for all
they're
men.
They're taught, though, they're taught in their training that you're not to do anything that's going to be an insult, because in some of those places it's a real serious insult. So you're supposed to eat everything before you, and I know, because we ran into some situations that weren't quite that bad, but for me, with my intestines missing, was a big serious thing. So okay, God knew, principles. God next handed down principles for punishment. Why would he do that right away? I mean, just Noah and his family and that, just, you know, God knows everything ahead of time that's going to happen. And he knew it was only a matter of time before the wickedness that was in man's heart would give outward expression in all manner of sin. It was just a matter of time. So the sin of first degree murder, one human being willfully taking the life of another human being, is laid out in verses 5 and 6. You want to read those verses?
Sure. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal and from each human being too. I will demand an accounting for the life of another human being. Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God, God has made mankind.
I was surprised in here. I'd never thought about it. You know, sometimes you can read something a whole bunch of times and it just goes over your head. I'd never before realized that God said man and animal. Animals are also going to be held accountable. You know? How did he say that there?
I will demand an accounting from every animal.
Yep, I will demand an accounting from every animal for the shedding of innocent blood. That's odd, isn't it? So that must mean that somewhere, somehow, I mean, we're always told animals don't have a soul, but somehow there must be something inside them that they know the difference of maybe what they're supposed to, you know, what's okay for them to kill because it's their food to survive, and what's being killed out of other, for other reasons, you know, that's not right or something. But that was really interesting. The principle of capital punishment was not given primarily as a deterrent to crime, but out of God's demand for reverence of him and respect for man, because, you know, human life is made in the image of God. So God's trying to instill in them right from the beginning to reverence man, because he's made in God's image. So you really are having reverence for God in that sense. In 18th century England, it was a felony to deface a coin that had the king's image on it. I mean, you would think something that silly, but it was a felony. You took and you defaced the king's face on that coin, and that was it, a felony. So defacing the coin was considered to be so disrespectful and dishonoring to the king that it cost the life of the person who did it. But just think about that. That's just a king, a manly king. If it was a felony to deface a coin with the king's image, how could it be considered less serious to deface the image of God by willfully taking another person's life? Because that's really what we're doing. We're defacing the value of that. In chapter 9, we find the first of the five covenants that God made in the Bible. He made five covenants with man. Whoever has verses 8 through 15. Is that you, Bridget?
Yes.
Did you read it?
Then God said to Noah, and to his sons with him, I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, and all the wild animals, all those that came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth, I establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be cut off from the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and a rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life.
So God understood Noah's weakness. That every time Noah heard of someone else's sin, he's going to be terrified that God's judgment's going to fall again. Think about it. What did he just go through? So why should Noah think something would be any different? So God didn't want him to live in fear all of the time, especially when population starts to grow and people start sinning again. So God is giving him this reassurance. He's making a covenant with him. Otherwise, Noah would live in constant fear. He'd be analyzing the sin in his own life and analyzing the sin in the world, trying to determine how much was too much, that it will all happen again. So as a solution to human weakness, God reassured Noah that his commitment to the preservation of the human race did not depend on man's goodness or on man's sinlessness, but on God's own word that he gave himself. He gave Noah a sign that would be more than just an encouragement. It would be the symbol of his covenant, his rainbow in the clouds. So that was the very first of the five covenants. The purpose was not for Noah to remember God's covenant, because God's not going to forget, but to remember that God remembered his commitment to the human race. God kept his word to Noah, and he's kept his word to all Noah's descendants all the way up until now. Something for us to be reminded of and think about every time we see a rainbow. Thousands of years after Noah, God made the fifth and the last covenant with man when he promised that he would make a new covenant. The contract was signed in the blood of Jesus. That was the last covenant. The fifth one. The other ones are in between. The one with David, the Davidic, and so on and so forth. The Abrahamic one. Like Noah, when we enter into this covenant, we are permanently, eternally saved from judgment for a new beginning in a new life. God knew that after our salvation, you know, the salvation experience that we had personally, as we sought to live a new life, we would sin again. He knew it. We just can't help ourselves. And because of the continuing struggle with sin and failure in our lives, we would be tempted to doubt our salvation. Same thing he was trying to spare Noah from doing then. So God gave us a sign of the new covenant. Jesus said it was the sign of his broken body and his poured out blood. It was the sign of the cross. That's our promise. That's our sign that God has promised us, that salvation, once we receive it, it is there. When we look at the cross, then we can remember that God remembers his promise to us, his covenant with us. In verses 20 and 21, tells us a little story here about Noah drinking too much wine. He gets drunk and he lays naked in his tent. How could a man of God act like that? How could a man of Noah's character and faith be found in such a position? How could he have experienced the power of God to bring him safely through the flood and then end up in a drunken stupor? Because Noah, like the rest of us, inherited the sinful nature. And maybe the wine was just that good, he couldn't resist drinking a little too much. Go ahead and read verses 22 and 23.
Ham, the father of Cana, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders. Then they walked in backward and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned the other way so that they could not see their father's nakedness.
So his son Ham saw his nakedness, and he ran and told his two brothers. The Hebrew text here in the original wording implies that Ham, he didn't just go tell his brothers, but he gloated. He gloated over the sight. So when he went to tell his brothers, it wasn't like he was just telling it in a nice way. It was like gossiping, but it was almost, it was disrespectful. Noah's other two sons, Shem and Japheth, reacted very differently, though, than Ham did. They covered their father's nakedness. The very action conveyed their love and their respect and their honor for their godly father. In the body of Christ, we need to be better at covering other people's nakedness. Because a lot of times what happens is instead we whisper it to others and we gossip and we spread it around. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was thinking about, it's the fifth commandment about honoring your father and mother, isn't it? Isn't it the fifth commandment?
I'm not sure if it's the fifth, but
of course this was
you may be right.
Before those, I guess, but nonetheless, with that in mind, Ham did not, and the other two sons did. Ham did the father. It had nothing to do with the father's actions. It's like we're to honor our father and mother regardless of whether they deserve it. We're just supposed to do it regardless of their actions. And
right, but they hadn't been given the commandments yet at
yes,
this point.
That's right.
But they should have just anyway, well, as their father honored him and respected him, you know.
God knew what those were.
Yes.
And that would have incorporated into their very essence probably to do that, and I was just thinking of
right.
That.
But that's something I think in that as believers we really need to think a lot more about today. Because what happens, you know, what if we left here tonight and on our way home we saw somebody from our church in a situation that wasn't good, wasn't right, okay? How many people would we go and tell that to? You know, and then it just perpetuates that and it spreads it around. And what is that doing? Nothing. It's showing their nakedness is what it is, instead of trying to cover their nakedness. And we need to really, I think more about some of that as Christians in some of the things that we do or say. Read verses 24 through 27.
When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Cana, the lowest of slaves, will he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. May Cana be a slave of Shem. May God extend the territory of Japheth. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem. And may Cana be his slave."
Just as many of the Old Testament patriarchs had done, Noah prophesied concerning his children. That was something that's very common in the Old Testament. The prophecies are amazing for their accuracy that's borne out in subsequent history. Ham's son was Canaan. Okay? Ham, the one who disrespected his father. So his son was Canaan. Canaan turned out to be rebellious. And Canaan's descendants were the Canaanites. The Canaanites were the ones that dragged Israel into idolatry in the beginning. And in time, they did become Israel's slaves later on. In contrast, Noah told Shem that his future would be tied up in a wonderful way with God. His descendants became the Shemites, or the Semitic tribes. That's the tribe that Abraham and his family came from. That's the nation of Israel came from that tribe. And Jesus came from that tribe. All the way. That's where it goes back to. Okay, so just the three sons. When you see where that ended up and what Noah had basically prophesied, whether it was in a blessing or a curse. The 66 books of the Bible were written almost exclusively by Shem's descendants. Almost all of them are traced back to Shem's descendants. What was he told? That he would have a future. His future would be tied up in a wonderful way with God. And it was all along, how God honored him. The Lord was indeed his God. And Japheth was told that he would become a large nation that would come to the tents of Shem, his brother, for a relationship with God. Well, that sounds a little odd back then, you know. What? How would that be? Seth's descendants are the Gentiles, who, in a very real sense, have to go to the tents of Shem, to the Bible, and to Jesus, in order to know God. So it came through just as it was said. But when it's spoken, just like today, when God speaks to us, sometimes it doesn't make any sense. You know? And we probably say, well, that person's way off. Or that word never happened. But look how many generations and centuries had to unfold before you'd see the fullness of these come forth. And then look back and be able to trace it through and understand it. Some of you here, I know, took the class I did that one year, The Forgotten Blessing. How many of you were in there? Okay. One of the things I loved about that class is because the blessing has been forgotten. It was something that was done from the beginning of time, and the father would always bless the children with a blessing. In the earlier years, they usually did that when they were close on their deathbed or close to death or really old, where they thought maybe they didn't have a lot of time left yet. Okay, but it didn't have to be at that point. They would bless them. And what they were doing was really prophesying over those children into their future. And God still uses that today. It's very important that we learn how to bless our children. Most adults today, and teens that you might know, who have really messed up lives, who are cutting themselves, who have low self-esteem, all kinds of problems, you know, stems back to they never got a blessing from their mother or their father. The blessing validates who you are. The blessing is that parent speaking into that person's life the things that they're asking God to instill in that life, which was the same thing that would happen with the name you gave your child. We don't do that anymore today unless we understand that, and then we do it. But they would always pick a name, like the Native American Indians. They would pick a name for qualities that they saw in that baby or qualities they hoped would be there as they grew up. And that's what happens when you bless, and you can bless your children no matter how old they are, even as adults. And I'm telling you, you will see a real difference when you do that. That's the best birthday present you could give them each year, is to sit them down, lay hands on them, and whether you thought it out ahead of time and wrote it down for them to keep, or you just spoke it off the top of your head. It's extremely powerful, but it's been forgotten in our culture today. And God's just teaching us more about those things so that we can get back in alignment with the tools He gave us. Okay, chapter 10. 10 and 11, the Tower of Babel. Noah and his descendants began to drift eastward after they got off the ark. And they continued to drift until they came to the wide, open, fertile plains of what would be modern-day Iran and Iraq. That's where they settled. I was going to bring my big map in heaven, put it up here projector. Because a lot of times people in our country don't know their geography. And to just see where these nations are today and what they've become based on what happened with Noah and his three sons, once you really get it, it's really astounding. But they settled first in what is today Iran and Iraq. Yet, now remember, God told them to move on and multiply and settle here. So they were obeying God at that point. Yet as they drifted, they didn't disperse. They didn't disperse, but instead they clung together. So as the years are going on now, they're clinging together in contradiction of God's command issued when He gave His covenant to Noah. So they're not doing what they were supposed to do at this point. Fill the earth, which implied a migration that would scatter the survivors throughout the world. You know, one this way, and so on and so forth until the earth became more populated. God had given them the same command twice to make sure there was no misunderstanding of what his will was for them. In Genesis 9, verse 1, he said it, and in verse 7, he said it again. It is possible that by the time the Tower of Babel was begun, there were thousands of people on the earth at that point. Centuries had gone by, okay? Genesis says, in chapter 11 and verses 1 and 2, it says, "Now, the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar, and they settled there." Okay, so now they are gradually migrating back to the region that was close to where the Garden of Eden had been. That's where they're going. Now, they don't know that. That's where they're going, okay? So in the plain of Shinar, they planned to settle together permanently and in direct defiance of God's stated command. They're doing the opposite. As Noah's descendants entered the plain of Shinar, they saw a vast, fertile region that would support their crops and their livestock. And as the settlers considered ending their migration and making a permanent home, Nimrod steps in. Nimrod was not a good character. Nimrod stepped into the picture as their leader. He took control. He became like a dictator. He was the grandson of Ham, Noah's son who disrespected him. Okay, now think of how the bloodline goes. Okay, Ham's bloodline doesn't bring good things. So now here's his grandson going to take control. The very name Nimrod means rebel in the original text. In chapter 10 and verses 8 and 9, it tells us that he grew to be a mighty warrior on the earth, a mighty hunter before the Lord. Nimrod was the lethal weapon, the Terminator, the Rambo of his day. He was so sure of himself that all the others put their trust in him. They just followed him. Rather than trust God to lead them, which is what they were supposed to be doing, okay? Noah's descendants looked to one of their own for leadership, and he led them into rebellion against God. Under Nimrod's leadership, Noah's descendants became the Babylonians. Not good. Whose very name is synonymous with rebellion against God. Verse 10 tells us that Nimrod built Nineveh, and we all know about Nineveh. Dennis, do you have verses 1 through 4 in chapter 11? No. Who has those? Brenda, could you read that, please?
"So the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastwards, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, 'Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly.' They used bricks instead of stone and carved for mortar. Then they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth.'"
So, under Nimrod's leadership, they began to make plans to build a city. Their work was not haphazard. It was carefully planned, organized, thought out. The stated purpose of that was to make a name for themselves. So they said it right up front. That was their goal. It wasn't because this is what God told us to do or this is because we're going to honor God. No. It's so we can make a name for ourselves to elevate man and his accomplishments above everything else. And when people look and they see this high tower, they're going to say, "Look what they did," instead of "Look at what God did." The means of accomplishing this goal would be to deliberately defy God by banding together. And their rallying point would be a tower that would reach into heaven. So this tower would symbolize a world religion that would serve as the opiate of the people, so to speak, giving them a deeper sense of meaning and purpose that would satisfy their craving for spiritual dimension of life. a satisfaction that was also false and would so preoccupy and distract them that it would keep them from the truth now. They're already starting to veer off. They decided to work their own way back into heaven without God by building a tower that would assist them. How many people do you know that says, I'll get to heaven my own way? They assumed that God would just have to accept them on their own merit, on their own terms. I guess they just figured they're going to show up there. And what is he going to do? Close the door on them? At that moment in human history, world religions were born. That was the beginning. There's a man named Karl Barth. He was one of the 20th century's premier theologians. And he said this, that all religion is man reaching up to God in his own way, according to his own terms, on his own merit, in his own strength. And that is a fact. Christianity alone is the only religion where God is reaching down to man.
Remember when Barth was key in Nazi Germany? He was one of the ones Bonhoeffer had to deal with.
Oh, and that's surprising, see? That demonic evil stuff was already... they knew what they were doing, I know. But think about that, it's true, that Christianity is the only religion where God reaches down to man. All the other religions, they're reaching up to some God somewhere. In their pride, the builders of Babel assumed that they could work their way into God's presence. Hi, here we are, God. We built our tower. We made it all the way up. Okay? And that he would have to accept them then on the basis of what they had done. He'd be so happy at what we accomplished on our own. And once again, the world that was in rebellion against God was being watched by God. He's just not sitting here sleeping. And it had his undivided attention. So in verse 5, it tells us, but the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the men were building. And in verse 6, it says, if as one people speaking the same language, they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Because God created the principle of unity. And he knew what could happen when they're all united as one. One voice. So, why was that so bad? Separated from God, humanity's skill and science and technology outstrip its wisdom. It outstrips the wisdom to use and apply what it knows, and man becomes exceedingly dangerous and wicked. We become too smart for our own good. Smart without the wisdom. And the only hope is that God will intervene and put a stop to man's rebellion, which is what God did at the Tower of Babel. What did he do? Go ahead and read verse 7.
Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other.
So the rebellion in our world today that is characterized by the defiance of God's way, the defiance of God's will, and the defiance of God's work, and the defiance of God's word, all leads to nothing but confusion. Let me see if I can find verses. I didn't give anyone verse 8 and 9, did I? Okay, let me find it here. Okay, so the Lord scattered them from there all over the earth, and they stopped building the city. And that is why it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world, and from there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So I guess they found out what he thought about their own thing. If they had dispersed in obedience to his command, like he had originally said, he would have gone with them where they went. Everywhere they would go, he would be with them. They would have known his presence, just as the Israelites later on when they were wandering, you know, when his presence was there with him, and they knew when the presence was there. Noah's descendants down through the centuries would have known God's presence, and because of his presence, they would have known his blessing and his guidance and his protection. And although he was still in control of their world, he was removed from them on a personal level. They didn't consult him. They didn't care about him. They just had their own plans. So he let them go into a terrible freedom that would lead them further and further and further away from him, deeper and deeper into sin and rebellion. God does that sometimes, doesn't he? Maybe he's done that for you in your life at some point. I know he did for me, you know. And he'll leave us there until we decide that we don't want to be there anymore, right? The descendants of Noah's three sons left Babel and the presence of God. It's that simple. They went out around the world like a plague of Cain's, spreading the epidemic of a rebellious, godless, sinful, wicked, defiant civilization wherever they went. It just happened, kept going. Now, let's look at where they went. Back to chapter 10. This is where they all spread out, okay? The descendants of Japheth were the first to leave, it tells us. So, when they left Babel, they headed north and west. Gomer, which was one of Japheth's family descendants, and they scattered in Germany, Turkey, and Armenia. Tubal and Magog, who were more of Japheth's children, they scattered and settled the Black Sea area, including the territory occupied by the former Soviet Union. Madai, who was one of Japheth's children, became what was known as the Medes and the Persians, who stayed in the Iran-Iraq area. Now, his descendants also can be traced to the Aryans in India. Not the Aryans like the Aryan race in Germany, not that. But the Aryans, A-R-Y-A-N-S, were the people of India. Another of Japheth's descendants was Javan, and he was the father of the Greeks and the Romans. Meshech's name is the root word for Moskva, from which they get the name of Russia's capital city, Moscow. That goes all the way back, okay? Tarshish, another child of Japheth, scattered out and settled in Spain. So they went far and wide into many different regions just from the one son of Noah. Now the other son, Ham, was the next one to pull out from Babel, it tells us, and he went south. And his descendants basically went in the opposite direction of Japheth's family, completely different. One of his sons was named Put. And Put scattered and settled in Libya and northern Africa. Mizraim became the father of the powerful and sophisticated Egyptians. They came out of Ham's line. Cush also settled in Ethiopia. Canaan's name was given to the territory that he settled. Remember the son Canaan. He settled, which we now think of as Palestine, the Palestinian area. Okay? Philistia, it was called. And that's where Canaan settled. And you see what it is today. Where, the Gaza Strip and all that stuff. It's the area that includes the Gaza Strip and the land of the Philistines. It was also part of the promised land that God gave to Abraham. Canaan's son, Sidon, his descendants were the ancient Phoenicians. And of course, we have the city of Sidon, where we've been. And you kind of just see those how the people are, how the countries are, which descendants they came from, which three of Noah's sons. Canaan also was the father of the Jebusites, whose holdings were seized by Israel's King David and became the city of Jerusalem. Canaan also fathered the Sinites, who were thought to be the progenitors of China and Japan. In Ham's descendants, we read a who's who of the enemies of God's people in the Old Testament. If you go back and read everything in the Old Testament, all the ones that were always attacking them and always were against them, they were all Ham's descendants. And it still goes today, does it not? Of who's always against Israel and the Jews. Pharaoh of Egypt was from Ham's descendants. Goliath, the giant of Philistia. The city of Nineveh, the city of Babylon, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, who became so wicked that God told the Israelites to drive them out from the land, along with the Canaanites who infected Israel with their wickedness. They brought in all the idolatry, idol worship. If left unchecked, sin not only is passed down to the next generation, but it increases with each passing generation. It gets worse and worse and worse. In the east, well, the Shemites, his son Shem's descendants, they didn't travel as far as the rest of them. Their descendants settled the area described as the Middle East. And we're told that sons were also born to Shem. Aram was the father of the Arameans, whose language is Aramaic, which was adopted as the first language, and it was commonly spoken in the day of Jesus. They spoke the Arabic, the Aramaic language. Uz, U-Z, settled northern Arabia, which was apparently the homeland of Job. Peleg's name means division, and he was named because when he was born, the earth was divided. They weren't all together in a cluster anymore. They were all divided out in different places. And this possibly refers, they think maybe, to the division of peoples as a result of God's judgment then at Babel. Ophar and Havilah settled the area of Saudi Arabia. And Eber, his name is the word for Hebrew, from whom descended Abraham and the Jews. So Noah's best son got all the good descendants, okay? Now these names, if you look through the Bible, these names comprise what they call the Table of Nations and the record of Noah's descendants through his three sons. Proverbs 13:12 tells us that hope deferred makes the heart sick. You all have heard that how many times? Following the rebellion at the Tower of Babel, the human race, which was separated now from God, was scattered all over the world in absolute, utter, eternal hopelessness at that point. There was no chance in a lifetime that the people could ever fulfill their potential. They would never know the Creator for whom they were created, or the very reason of their existence. But there was hope in God's plan. Is there not always? Because God is a God of hope. Everything he does, he has a plan for hope. Almost from the moment that God let the world go at the Tower of Babel, he began already unfolding his plan to reconcile this wayward world to himself. And he did this by reaching down into the world of humanity that was in rebellion against him, and down into the, he reached into one nation, one tribe, one family, for which he chose one man through whom he would begin making preparations for sending the Redeemer. In Genesis 11:26, it tells us, after Terah had lived 70 years, he became the father of Abraham, actually of Abram, before his name had been changed. He became the father of Abram. Abram, a descendant of Noah, was just one man among thousands of people on the earth at that time. Yet verse 28 tells us that Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, and Sarai, and left Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But they came first to Haran, and they settled there. They were supposed to go to Canaan, but they weren't there yet. They got waylaid in Haran. Abram's father was headed to Canaan from Ur. Canaan was a very prosperous land, and actually, in Exodus, it tells us that the land of Canaan was filled with milk and honey. But Abram's father died in Haran, so they never made it to Canaan. They just stayed there and lived there. And it would be another 5 years that would go by before Abram left now for Canaan. See, God had a plan, but they got a little bit off the path like we do sometimes, don't we? We make a stop somewhere we shouldn't. We make a detour. But that's okay. God said, you know, I got a plan. We'll get them back on track. Satan loves to use trauma to shut down our dreams. Think about that in your own situations. There are, you know, they had a trauma. The father died. The father died, okay, so they all just stayed where they were because it was easier. Because they were in a trauma. They had a loss. Probably were grieving. There are some valuable lessons in this story concerning Abram's family. Abram's family was called to go to Canaan years before God visited Abram in Genesis chapter 12. See, we didn't get to that yet. But he was called, God had a plan already and knew he was going to call Abram to Canaan. Many times a traumatic incident such as a death, a failure, a financial setback, health challenges, maybe a bad accident, or a host of many other things that can stagnate and even stop us from making progress in God, of where he had us heading. Abram's family was destined. They had a destiny. Who was going to come out of that? They had a big, important destiny. They had no clue. But they were destined to make it to Canaan. But when Abram's dad died, they decided to camp out in Haran, a land that they were never supposed to stay in anyway. And interestingly, Haran means parched. So they camped out in a dry, parched land. Well, God had milk and honey over here for them in Canaan. How much milk and honey does he have for us that we haven't seen yet because we're still stuck on the wrong path? Why would Abram and his family remain in a dry, parched location when they were supposed to be headed towards Canaan? Trauma. Trauma is a tool of the enemy to keep us from advancing in God. See, we can read all these things in there. We go, oh, these old musty books and these old stories and things. But as Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun. The enemy is the same enemy. He uses the same tactics on us that he did thousands of years ago on God's people. Nothing's changed. The only difference is we know about it. We read the stories. We know about it. We go, aha, I'm wise to what's going on here. Because I remember what happened to those other people, and I'm not going to fall for it. But like Abram, while following God's destiny for our lives, it's not uncommon for us to experience setbacks. We've all had setbacks. Although God will use these perceived setbacks, as we call them, as opportunities to strengthen our character. And Satan will try to use these experiences instead to make us bitter, or make us resentful, or angry, or depressed, or succumb to a host of other negative emotions. That's what ends up happening. Once we open our souls up to these negative emotions, our soul becomes wounded and in need of healing. And when our soul becomes wounded, we're no longer able to advance with God. Remember, God's always advancing. The whole solar system, they know, is still moving. It's never stopped. It's still going forward. God is always an advancing, moving God. So we can't stay stuck. But we're not able to advance with him when these things happen and we let ourselves get into these emotions that are negative because when we get negative, our soul, our mind, our will, our emotions no longer have the capacity to receive everything that God's trying to bless us with. We're not able to at that point. However, later, next week, Genesis chapter 12, when God came and he visited Abram and he shared with him his prophetic promise Then Abram gained revelation, and he gained revelation about his purpose. He now had a new purpose. God's revealing it to him. Abram took the prophetic word, and he used it as a tool to advance towards his destiny. And that's why God gives us prophecy, because the prophetic word is a tool that helps us to advance toward our destiny that God has for us. God wants your soul wounds healed so that you can move towards your promised land, whatever that is that God has for you. So next week, we'll be doing chapters 12 and 13 when we start getting into Abram, and we'll move our timeline finally again. But it kind of just helps, and we'll finally be on a date. We've been in the undated area, you know, this far, but we'll be in there. Any comments or questions?
Did you notice as they were going on, they were living almost 1,000 years in the first part, but as they went on and on and after Babel, their lifespan dropped down to just mere nothing?
Yes.
You know, it just, I don't know.
They had a lot of theories, different theories as to why they think that happened, you know.
They got what they deserved, I guess. I don't know if you'd want to say anything different.
Well, there won't be time to go into all those now, but there's several different theories as to why that is. I don't know if I'd want to live that long. Not unless God would give us a really superhuman body, okay? But I don't know. Anyone else? A question, a comment? And for you weren't here earlier, Brenda. Every week this is put up on the church website. So like if you can't make a class or something, you can just go and log on to the website into the tab for the classes, and it's in there. Okay? Now, Bob has asked, and we've gotten done early so we can do this. We're done 15 minutes early tonight. Bob has asked if we could all lay hands on a handkerchief that he's going to anoint with anointing oil, and he wants to take that to Debbie Wilton because go ahead.
This was not by accident. For two Sundays in a row, the pastor had mentioned some kind of an illness that few people know about, and I don't.
Right. For the 18 years that pastor referred to, he's talking about.
And early Monday morning, in my quiet time, the Lord impressed on me of Acts chapter 19. And you're all familiar with it, leaven, so that even the handkerchiefs and aprons were brought from his body to the sick. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I had a ministry together of anointing handkerchiefs. And I'm telling you, we have a strong faith in it. And the Lord laid it on me that we should, and I don't know why, and he said to anoint a handkerchief here on Thursday night, and have Anne, who is very close to the pastor, bring the handkerchief and put it in before they go to bed at night, to put it in the pillowcase, you know, so that she would be sleeping on it. This morning I had confirmation of that.
Really?
There was a brother that had family problems, and he took a pillow, took three deep breaths. At each breath, he breathed the Holy Spirit into that pillow, and as the person was laying on it sleeping, that he would come to the Lord.